From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anthony Doerr's book, All the Light We Cannot See, just won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It was a National Book Award finalist, and it's been a bestseller. The stats are amazing. 51 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It has 1.6 million copies in circulation across hardcover and ebook format. It's a literary, lyrical novel, a complicated novel, a novel embraced by the toughest critics and seemingly everybody else. This hour on Point, author Anthony Doerr on his book, All the Light We Cannot See. You can join us on air or online, listeners. Have you read All the Light We Cannot See? What did you take away from it? Has the Pulitzer put it on your radar? Join us at onpointradio.org, on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Paris is Anthony Doerr, author of All the Light We Cannot See. He's also author of the short story collection Memory Wall and the memoir Four Seasons in Rome. Anthony, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane. It's great to be here.
Well, congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize. What a wonderful, powerful book.
Thank you. Thanks.
Introduce us to the story, to the time, and to the characters.
Sure, you bet. The story is really kind of two novels braided around each other. One is about a French girl named Marie-Laure, and she is blind. She's visually impaired, and she grows up at the Natural History Museum in the 1930s, and her father is in charge of all the locks there. There are thousands and thousands of locks in the museum, and I had a lot of fun imagining what his job would have been like. And then, of course, as 1938-39 loom, and then, of course, the invasion of Paris in June of 1940, she's they're forced to flee, and they go to the seaside Breton town of Saint-Malo. And meanwhile, the narrative alternates very quickly back and forth between Marie-Laure and a German boy named Werner. And Werner has quite a different upbringing. He has no parents and is quite close with his sister Jette and grows up in a coal town in Germany. And he's a very curious boy and is particularly interested in electrical engineering and radios and finds that he has a certain gift for repairing radios at a time when everybody wanted to be listening to the radio. Hmm. And this gift kind of gets him out of going into the mines at age 15, like most of the boys around him. But it ultimately sets him on a path both to intersect with Marie-Laure and also to have to make some very complicated moral decisions.
Hmm. The characters are so magnificently laid out. Before we get into the story and more about the characters, talk about the title of the book, All the Light We Cannot See.
Sure. That's what we're using right now to talk to each other from 4,000 miles apart. I originally had the idea, I was taking a train from Princeton, New Jersey into New York City, and there was a man in this train seat in front of me. You know, we're going whatever, 50 or 60 miles per hour, and we start going underground, and he's talking on his cell phone about the sequel to the movie The Matrix. I'll never forget it, you know, sort of maybe a mundane thing to be talking about. And his call cut out as we started to enter the city and go towards Penn Station. And he got quite angry, got maybe a little bit unreasonably angry. And after I stopped fearing for my own safety for a second, I started thinking, you know, what we're all doing all the time is taking this miracle for granted. You know, we're really the first two or three, maybe four generations of people in the history of the world that have been able to talk and communicate over great distances. You know, he's using radio towers that are miles apart and transmitting these little packets of light between them at the speed of light. And he could be talking to somebody in Australia for all I know, or Madagascar. So I wrote the title down that day. Usually the titles come later to me, but that day, All the Light We Cannot See came to me. I was just primarily in the beginning thinking about radio and how, you know, there's so much light out there, cosmic rays and radio waves and microwaves, all these different kinds of electromagnetic radiation that are hitting the Earth all the time that we're not capable of seeing. You know, mathematically, really, visible light is infinitesimal. It's almost insignificant mathematically. So, you know, there's so many things we can't see. And then, of course, you know, once you start playing around with it and you get years into a project, I started playing with all kinds of other metaphorical ideas about light and darkness and visibility and invisibility. And, of course, children tie into that in the way lots of times in war, especially thinking about your previous hour of this show, you know, in war, what stories about children are kind of lost to us and what kind of light is that we're not seeing?
Mm. Gosh, there's so much here. It's so rich. You mentioned it took years. Indeed, it took you 10 years to write this book. You wrote a short story collection and a memoir in between. Did you take long breaks from this book?
I did, yeah. You know, some of it was procrastination because this book was complicated. And some of it was a function of the research being pretty harrowing, you know, especially when you start reading about the Hitler Youth, the Eastern Front, the, you know, the level of destruction of human beings in the Ukraine and Russia and Poland. Some days, if I wasn't teaching, that would be all I did that day was just read about the destruction of human beings. So sometimes I would come home without a lot of positive things to say to my wife and kids. So I would take breaks to work on either, magazine pieces or short stories.
Let's go back to Marie. She was blind. She grew up in this magical place, a natural history museum in Paris with a very loving father. The stories that you weave of her learning to navigate the streets of her little town with a little wooden model made by her father, who sharpens her mind by hiding birthday treats in intricate little puzzle boxes that he carves. She experiences the world through touch and through smell and through sound in such a powerful way. Would you read a bit from the book about Marie? Set this up for us?
Yes, you bet. I have a passage that's a little bit later in the book, so hopefully it doesn't give too much away. This is after Marie has arrived in the town of Saint-Malo, and this is about 7 months after the invasion of France and the occupation has begun. And her father has been missing, at least to her, for almost 4 weeks now. And her caretaker, Madame Manek, has taken her outside for the first time in months, and she's gotten to the beach. And this is the first time she's been close to the ocean. Marie-Laure unwinds her scarf, and Madame Manek takes it. Briny, weedy, pewter-colored air slips down her collar. Madame? Yes. What do I do? Just walk. She walks. Now there are cold, round pebbles beneath her feet. Now crackling weeds. Now something smoother, wet, unwrinkled sand. She bends and spreads her fingers. It's like cold silk, cold, sumptuous silk onto which the sea has laid offerings, pebbles, shells, barnacles, tiny slips of wrack. Her fingers dig and reach. The drops of rain touch the back of her neck, the backs of her hands. The sand pulls the heat from her fingertips, from the soles of her feet. A months-old knot inside Marie-Laure begins to loosen. She moves along the tide line, almost crawling at first, and imagines the beach stretching off in either direction, ringing the promontory, embracing the outer islands, the whole filigreed tracery of the Breton coastline with its wild capes and crumbling batteries and vine-choked ruins. She imagines the walled city behind her, its soaring ramparts, its puzzle of streets, all of it suddenly as small as Papa's model. But what surrounds the model is not something her father conveyed to her. What's beyond the model is the most compelling thing. A flock of gulls squalls overhead. Each of the 100,000 tiny grains of sand in her fists grinds against its neighbor. She feels her father pick her up and spin her around 3 times. No occupation soldier comes to arrest them. No one even speaks to them. In 3 hours, Marie's numb fingers discover a stranded jellyfish, an encrusted buoy, and 1,000 polished stones. She wades to her knees and silks the hem of her dress. When Madame Manek finally leads her, damp and dazzled, back to the Rue Vauborel, Marie-Laure climbs all 5 flights and raps on the door of Etienne's study and stands before him, wet sand stuck all over her face. "You were gone a long time," he murmurs. "I worried." "Here, uncle." From her pockets, she brings up shells, barnacles, cowries, 13 lumps of quartz, gritty with sand. "I brought you this, and this, and this, and this."
I have to say, this is the kind of book that you take with you to in the car when you're getting gas. You have to open it up and read. You cannot put it down. All the different places at lunch, at work. It's so magical. I am curious why you chose another blind character in this book. Your previous work, The Shell Collector, you had a blind protagonist as well. What was it that was challenging for you as a writer, and why did you go that route?
Great question. Some of those decisions are unconscious ones. I don't know why I'm continually drawn to characters with disabilities. Part of it is My wife's oldest sister is disabled, and being around her, of course, can be hard work, but it's also reminds you to slow down, and that the world can be a really sweet and beautiful and a very simple place. And so part of it is that. And part of it is, I think, I always like sentences that reach beyond the visual. I think as novelists and short story writers and poets, we writers have an advantage that filmmakers don't, that almost any other storytelling medium doesn't, and that we can mimic the pattern of thought, and we can work with smells and sounds and textures and beyond. You know, we can move into media beyond the visual. So I always like to, you know, fall in love with sentences that, you know, have multiple components of sense, that they're trying to transport a reader fully into a place.
And really quickly before our break here, why this period in history? Why write about World War II?
I knew early on I wanted to find a time and place when radio was the paramount technology. And hopefully all the time, particularly towards the end of the book, I want the reader to be thinking about the internet. You know, I think the best historical fiction somehow reflects contemporary times, of course, as well. So I wanted to somehow suggest, you know, here was radio, this neutral technology, and here are the Germans used it as an instrument to promote violence, and how the resistance used it as an instrument to combat violence.
We're talking to Anthony Doerr about his book, All the Light We Cannot See, which just won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. We'll go out here with Claude Debussy's Claire de Lune, played by Alexis Weisenberg. In All the Light We Cannot See, Marie's great-uncle Etienne played it in his house in Saint-Malo. Back with much more after this. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're speaking with Anthony Doerr this hour, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, All the Light We Cannot See. Talk about your other main character, Werner. His father died in the mine. He had a gift for repairing radios, as you mentioned. Tell us about him.
Sure. Werner is a very curious boy. He's blind in some ways, in ways that Marie-Laure is not. He's As this novel goes on, I don't want to give too much away, but he's incapable of seeing certain things that the Third Reich is doing around him, and he wants to focus on just engineering. And I kept wondering, you know, he's really a dreamer, and I kept wondering, you know, what would happen to a boy like that during the war. I have a son who's very much like that, can be very focused on a project while the rest of the world kind of moves on around him. And I just kept thinking, you know, how grateful I am that he wasn't growing up in Germany in the 30s.
Here's a bit from the book, a description of Werner in his early years. Would you read it?
Yes. This is 1934, and they live in a town called Solferein. Werner grows up 300 miles northeast of Paris in a place called Solferein, a 4,000-acre coal mining complex outside Essen, Germany. It's steel country, anthracite country, a place full of holes. Smokestacks fume, and locomotives trundle back and forth on elevated conduits, and leafless trees stand atop slag heaps like skeleton hands shoved up from the underworld. Werner and his younger sister Jutta are raised at Children's House, a clinker brick two-story orphanage on Victoria Strasse, whose rooms are populated with the coughs of sick children and the crying of newborns, and battered trunks inside which drowse the last possessions of deceased parents, patchwork dresses, tarnished wedding cutlery, faded ambrotypes of fathers swallowed by the mines. Werner's earliest years are the leanest. Men brawl over jobs outside the Solferein gates, and chicken eggs sell for 2 million Reichsmarks apiece, and rheumatic fever stalks Children's House like a wolf. There is no butter or meat. Fruit is a memory.
Some evenings, during the worst months, all the house directress has to feed her dozen wards are cakes made from mustard powder and water. But 7-year-old Werner seems to float. He is undersized and his ears stick out, and he speaks with a high, sweet voice. The whiteness of his hair stops people in their tracks. Snowy, milky, chalky, a color that is the absence of color. Every morning he ties his shoes, packs newspaper inside his coat as insulation against the cold, and begins interrogating the world. He captures snowflakes, tadpoles, hibernating frogs. He coaxes bread from bakers with none to sell. He regularly appears in the kitchen with fresh milk for the babies. He makes things, too, paper boxes, crude biplanes, toy boats with working rudders. Every couple of days, he'll startle the directress with some unanswerable query. Why do we get hiccups, Frau Elena? Or, if the moon is so big, Frau Elena, how come it looks so little? Or, Frau Elena, does a bee know if it's going to die, if it stings somebody?
We're listening to Anthony Doerr, best-selling author of the book All the Light We Cannot See, which just won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Talk about the process of researching this novel, Anthony. There are so many historical facts that shape the narrative. What was the work like preparing to write it, to research it?
A lot of reading. And, you know, really, I try to infuse this notion to my students as well. Really, a lot of it was research as I went. Sometimes you have to write yourself into the unknown to figure out what it is you need to learn. So lots of times you would lay out a few paragraphs and then understand, oh, I got to go to the Natural History Museum and figure out how keys were used in the 1930s, or you know, what an orphanage might have looked like in a rural town in Germany near a coal mine. So sometimes you kind of have to build your narrative and your research together all at the same time. And for me, it's kind of a three-part process, about a third reading, a third travel, an experience trying to talk to people and look at places, get a sense of what the light is like in different seasons and, you know, what birds are there and what the place smells like. And then the last third is really imagination. You know, this book is pretty heavily influenced by fable and playing a lot with, you know, you can hear it a little bit in that section. Werner's hair is very white. He's very small. And Marie is, in many ways, kind of a girl with limits on one side, but extremely powerful and brave on another side. And then, of course, there's an ogre in the novel as well, this character Von Rumpel, who's hunting them. So a lot of the book is, of course, carefully researched, but much of it is also a product of the imagination.
Sheila on Facebook wants to know, she says, I'm interested in how you researched the mining orphans' lives.
Yeah, Zollverein is a pretty amazing place. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And some of it was just looking at photographs, you know, and just staying at home in Idaho and looking through old photographs and trying to imagine what those rooms were like. And, you know, also trying to figure out, you know, how would a boy escape this fate of his, you know? I mean, he's really trapped between becoming a soldier and becoming a miner. And, you know, how can Werner figure his way out? So a lot of it is sitting there looking at photographs and then dreaming, you know. For me, research could really be a procrastination. The problem with World War II, one of my friends once told me, it's probably not true, but he said if you tore all the pages out of all the books written about World War II and dropped them on Germany, it would cover the entire country. So, you know, you could read forever about subjects, even just radio or blindness, you know, or natural history museums, you can read forever. So eventually you have to say, okay, I'm just procrastinating now. I need to go back to work and stop reading.
So many listeners lined up to talk with you, Anthony. Let's get to Elizabeth in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Elizabeth. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you.
Yes.
What a wonderful book. I just enjoyed it thoroughly. The character descriptions, the richness, the historical novel. I just loved it. An all-time favorite of mine now.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. That's very nice. Thank you.
Here's Lancey in London, sure. England. Hi, Lancey. Welcome to On Point with Anthony Doerr.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Yeah, I'm calling from London, actually originally from Lakeville, Connecticut, and I read All the Light They Cannot See last summer and was really interested. I loved it, incidentally, but I was particularly interested because I grew up in Brittany for part of my childhood and was really sort of struck by the choice of Saint-Malo because I went there a lot as a kid, and so I was just kind of wondering why Anthony chose to set the book there, and actually what the research process was like, because I know most, if not all, of Saint-Malo was destroyed during World War II, and I was kind of wondering if the complete destruction of the city had any impact on the research process.
Lancey, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lancey. Unlike you, I was a foolish American. I wasn't, it wasn't until my 30s that I even knew what Saint-Malo was. I was on book tour in France. I was at the end of a pretty long tour, which sounds glamorous, but they can get a little bit grueling towards the end. And we entered Brittany after dark. And so I hadn't really even seen the ocean. And we were taken to a dinner. There's a lot of journalists. And it wasn't until probably 11 at night that I kind of escaped out the back door and walked up. We were in Saint-Malo, but I hadn't really seen it. Walked up three flights of stairs and found myself atop the ramparts. This is an old walled city, really surrounded by water almost entirely on four sides. And when you're up on the ramparts at night in particular, you know, it was low tide, so the moonlight is glinting off this wet sand to my right. And then to my left, you can see into the houses. And, you know, maybe even with the third story of people's houses, I could see people sitting down at tables and walking past windows. And, I think I just felt as if I had entered an Italo Calvino fable, you know, an old story. And I had been searching for a place to set this book about radio. And it wasn't until the next day, walking with my French editor, and I said all these typically foolish American touristy things like, you know, look how old everything is. Everything is so old here. And he told me, actually, Saint-Malo was almost entirely destroyed in August of 1944 by Allied bombs and artillery. And, you know, just the act of recreation of the city, so much so that I could definitely guess that a quarter of the people who visit Saint-Malo don't understand that the whole city was rebuilt in the late 40s and 50s. That amazed me, and also just the the way history can kind of be written over, in a sense that memory is something that needs to be kept alive, and that's certainly true for the war right now. As we lose every day, we lose more and more people for whom the war is memory, and it becomes more of a function of history and less of a function of people who remember these events.
Anthony Doerr, there's a question that comes up in the book that I wanted to ask you about. Seems to be a theme throughout your work, which is, quote, "Don't you want to be alive before you die?" End quote. Can you tell us about that phrase?
Yeah, sure. I've always felt that. I don't know. You know, I went to a Montessori school, and my mother was a science teacher there, and she was an amazing teacher in a thousand ways, but she always had us doing timelines. Really, like at Montessori school, we were doing timelines from kindergarten. And I remember very acutely this exercise she had us do where we roll a toilet paper roll all the way down a hallway, and you're asked to mark the various eras of, you know, the Cambrian and, all the way up to Paleozoic and then, you know, the time of humans, and you're on the last square of toilet paper before you even get towards any kind of hominid that looks like a human. And you're really on the last sliver of toilet paper when you get to all of recorded history. You know, the last millimeter of toilet paper fits ancient Greece and Rome and China and Egypt. And so for some, maybe that's the reason I've just always had this acute sense of larger scales of time and how short of a time we get to be here on Earth. If you're so lucky and you live until you're 75, you know, why not try to learn as much as you can about the world while you're here and see what you can and be as good to as many people as you can, because, you know, we really only get this finger snap of time.
Here's Peter from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Peter. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
My question is, sorry.
Oh, please go ahead, Peter.
Yes. I'm just in the first chapter of the book, and so far, so good. But I wondered if the author, lack of the use of the past tense in the book. Everything is told in the present tense, and that seems to be more and more in usage these days, not only in literature, but on the television and on the radio as well. Is that something that was a conscious decision, or is that something that's just the way things are now?
Okay, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Ask the Pulitzer Prize winner. He will know.
I don't know. I mean, I certainly don't know if it's in vogue or not. It's definitely my last book, Memory Wall. Almost all the stories, although not all of them, were told in the present tense.
And yes, this book just started to fall into place in the present tense. For me, it's more of a matter of feel. I like the sound of the present tense and playing with a lot of S's. Sentences are all about the music of language for me, and I like working with that. I felt that, especially because the book also pivots back and forth between time, between the siege of San Malo in August of 1944 and then all the events leading up to it. There are 13 sections in the book, and they alternate back and forth. And I kept all of that in present tense. I felt like I would confuse every reader that, you know, the only people who would read this book were my mom and my wife and my agent. So
little did you know.
I know. So maybe it is in vogue, but I'm certainly not really paying attention to that as much as, you know, just making the choice in terms of some kind of subconscious pleasure at the sound. And for the work I'm working on right now, for some reason, is also slipping into the present tense. But I am fully aware that that is a risk and that you can confuse readers, especially when you're moving back and forth in time. And, of course, you know, the tradition for decades in historical fiction has been to tell it in the past tense.
Let's go to Fran in Boston. Hi, Fran. Glad you called. Welcome.
Thank you, Jane, for taking my call.
Yes.
And thank you, Mr. Doerr, for writing this beautiful book. I started to read it last night, and I thought, on point this morning, how does this make the stars line up? And here you are discussing it. And it's just so beautiful to me and so lyric. I don't read a lot of fiction because I'm usually disappointed, but this book is just beautiful. And what has struck me in the maybe 60 pages I've read is your punctuation, Mr. Doerr, and for some reason, your use of periods after one word and then another word in a period speaks to me in musical terms. I'm not a musician, but it seems like very staccato, and it just brings home your point, and I am riveted, and I hear music in my head.
Wow. Fran, thank you. She should write something for the back of the cover.
Yeah, thank you, Fran.
Thank you,
maybe
Fran.
We're related.
But many chapters, she speaks of the lyrical nature, the sort of musical nature of your writing, which is exactly right. And also, a lot of chapters end with, they end with cliffhangers, right? You ask the reader to hold on while you catch up with the other strand of the story that you sort of weave together in this alternating narrative. It takes a long time for the strands to come together, right? Did you worry the reader would stay with you until the end to get there?
Yes, of course. I worried about it a great deal. Yes, you know, maybe something that's slightly unusual about this novel is that the chapters are quite short. There are 187 chapters in it, and few go more than 3 pages, and several are less than 1 page. And for me, you know, maybe this is also a kind of procrastination, or maybe it's a function of becoming a father. You know, my boys are 11 now, and so really the whole time I wrote this book, I had young children. But I liked working in short bursts of time, usually 2 or 3 hours, and working on one chapter and just trying to make it a little bit tighter or a little bit stronger. And so sometimes, you know, I would be combing through punctuation, like Fran said, periods and commas, and just trying to make everything as clean as I could. But yeah, the narration alternates back and forth between Marie and Werner quite quickly. And I felt like that could be a substantial risk, that a reader might feel like she's watching a tennis match or a ping pong match and her head's moving back and forth too quickly. And then, yes, I'm asking the reader to wait for almost the entire novel for the two protagonists to intersect. And I felt like that was yet another reason the book would have very few readers, that I was testing the patience of readers. But I think in some ways there might be a pleasure in feeling these two slightly inclined lines lean toward each other, and you kind of wait to see them intersect.
We're speaking with Anthony Doerr this hour about his best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning book, All the Light We Cannot See. We'll go out with Itzhak Perlman and the London Philharmonic Orchestra playing the Allegro movement, Autumn, of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, a piece that Marie's great-uncle Etienne played in his house in Saint-Malo in the book. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. More to come. This is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. Glad you're joining us for the On Point podcast, sponsored by Audible.com. Many of the books featured on the show, like John Swed's Billie Holiday, The Musician, and The Myth, are available for you to listen to whenever and wherever you wish on Audible.com. It's like having your own personal library with over 180,000 titles that you can enjoy while driving, on the train, just about anywhere. As an incentive to get you to try this service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint, and you can get started today.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with Anthony Doerr, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, All the Light We Cannot See. Let's get to more callers here. Rita in Hampton, New Hampshire. Hi, Rita. Glad you called and waited. Thanks for being here. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes.
Take me on here. Yes, I was born in 1929, and in Germany and in Düsseldorf, it's on the Rhine, and on the other side where the French occupation. And these were the most unbelievable times that probably any country can go through. And there was an unbelievable inflation. And people, my father went to, when he had to go to the bank and get some money. And my first memory from my childhood on, I was 3 years old, it must have been in 1932, to see my mother strangely looking at my father, and I'd never seen anything like that, the way she looked at him and he at her, and then he went off. And later I learned that people got killed when they came out of a bank because there was no money around. We had already an inflation there about, I don't know, I remember only that in 1940 or so, during the war, we had to clean our attic because there were new bombs, fire bombs, and the whole attic would go up in flame if we had to clean it up because my father kept so many newspapers and so forth.
And, Rita, these are incredible memories. You need to read this book. I think it will really resonate with you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for calling. Let's get David in here from Williamstown, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane, and congratulations, Mr. Doerr. I'm not much of a fiction reader. I read a lot, but it's usually nonfiction. I'll dip into fiction books from time to time, start them, and not finish them. But this was just fantastic. I read it over the winter, and I had two questions. First of all, you touched on this before, but how did you come to the decision to go with the short chapters? That really worked well for me, and there were times where I would go, oh, I can read just one more. I can read just one more because it's only a couple of pages. And second of all, I don't want to give away anything in the story, but any background or enlightenment on the German soldier character, the rather large lummoxy fellow who was frightening but intriguing at the same time, I found him very interesting. I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
David, thank you. Anthony Doerr.
Thank you, David. Yes, your second question refers to Volkheimer, who it touches me that you ask about him because I rarely do get asked about him. I went to college with some big guys, and I just have always been drawn to what it's like to be large. One of my good friends was 6'7", 6'8", and, you know, his life was interesting. He was asked all the time how tall he is. You know, sitting in cars and planes was harder for him than you think, and So I really started Volkheimer very simply just imagining one of my big friends. And yes, he is, in one definition, he's a mass murderer, but he's also very sweet towards Werner. And without giving too much away, I think I hope that a reader understands what a complicated thing it is to empathize with Volkheimer, because he is committing atrocities on one hand, but on the other hand, he's being told to do so. And he's in a very complicated moral position. And as for the short chapters, again, it was kind of a thing of feel. I really was trying to work with, a reader's expectations. Some of my prose can be very dense in terms of detailing. I kind of fall in love with detailing.
And so I like to try to give a reader a little breath, much in the way any, or say 70% of poetry collections give the reader a pause when there's white space after a poem. I feel like in some ways white space can be a moment to collect yourself before you plunge in again. So making, even though it's quite a long book, filling the book with white space, in a sense, makes it slightly more friendly to a reader.
Anthony Doerr, earlier you spoke about about radio and its interest to you and the importance of radio in Germany during World War II, certainly a tool for the Nazis, but also a tool for those trying to subvert the Nazis. And it was a link in your book between your characters, Marie and Werner. Read a bit, another piece, another section of the book about the magic of radio.
Of course. You have to swear, Jette says. Do you swear? Amid rusted drums and shredded inner tubes and wormy creek bottom muck, she has discovered 10 yards of copper wire. Her eyes are bright tunnels. Werner glances at the trees, the creek, back to his sister. I swear. Together they smuggle the wire home and loop it back and forth through nail holes in the eave outside the attic window. Then they attach it to their radio. Almost immediately, on a shortwave band, they can hear someone talking in a strange language full of Z's and S's. Is it Russian? Werner thinks it's Hungarian. Jette is all eyes in the dimness and heat. How far away is Hungary? 1,000 kilometers? She gapes. Voices, it turns out, streak into Solferine from all over the continent, through the clouds, the coal dust, the roof. The air swarms with them. Jette makes a log to match a scale that Werner draws on the tuning coil, carefully spelling the name of each city they manage to receive. Verona, 65. Dresden, 88. London, 100. Rome, Paris, Lyon. Late night shortwave, province of ramblers and dreamers, madmen and ranters. After prayers, after lights out, Jette sneaks up to her brother's dormer. Instead of drawing together, they lie hip to hip, listening till midnight, till one, till two. They hear British news reports they cannot understand. They hear a Berlin woman pontificating about the proper makeup for a cocktail party. One night, Werner and Jette tune into a scratchy broadcast in which a young man is talking in feathery, accented French about light.
Anthony Doerr, winner of 2015 Pulitzer Prize for All the Light We Cannot See. Here's Virginia in Woodstock, Vermont. Hi, Virginia. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
One of the things about this fabulous book, one of the best I've ever read, was the use of verbs that just make things come alive, and they're used in such an unusual way. For example, in describing the bombing of Saint-Malo, flames scamper up walls, parked automobiles catch fire as through curtains and lampshades and so on. The fires pool and strut. They flow up the sides of the ramparts like tides. They splash into alleys, over rooftops, through a car park. Smoke chases dust. Ash chases smoke. A newsstand floats, burning. Unusual use of verbs that make things totally come alive. And this is such a timely broadcast today because my book group is meeting tonight to talk about it. So it's wonderful to hear you, Anthony Doerr, and to hear how you wrote the book, things you thought about, how you researched, and so on.
That's
absolutely
great.
Absolutely fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling, Virginia. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you, Virginia. That's very nice. I love verbs. I like to play around with verbs. I think I still have the terror of my middle school and elementary school English teachers saying, you know, is the to be verb. Don't use is so much. It's flat. You need active verbs. Oh, I think anytime I find myself reverting to he is strong, I'm always saying, like, how can I demonstrate that strength with better verbs?
Oh, no, you definitely got the message. You talked about the German character, Wolheimer. Tell us about the very moving friendship between Werner and the character Frederick in the book.
Sure. Yeah, Frederick is a true dreamer. Werner's a dreamer. Frederick is a dreamer squared. He is in love with birds and is able to identify birds by their calls and is just born into the wrong family, a family that is really trying to climb the ranks of the party in Germany and is much more concerned with how they look and how they appear to their neighbors than with the welfare of their own son. Fenner's skills get him sent to a school. These schools were real. They were called Napola schools, and they were there were over 20 of them in Germany, and in some cases, girls were sent to them as well. This school is all boys, and you know, where they would teach proper engineering along with horrific things like phrenology and racism and, of course, all kinds of different tools of violence. And the school is really built on bullying, trying to winnow out the quote-unquote weaker boys. And Frederick is introduced in many ways to show the reader that it was possible, it is possible for somebody to recognize that what their government and their leaders are doing around them is wrong. The costs for Frederick are terrible, but Werner chooses maybe not to pay as much attention to what Germany is doing around him, and his friendship with Frederick is strained or destroyed because of that.
Here's Hugh in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Hi, Hugh. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have an observation more than a question.
Okay.
Apart from being the best book I read all year last year, and I'm 1,000-page-a-weeker, it's so poetic. I was reminded in the first dozen pages of, say, some of the great works of the past, like Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men, which just, and you're the woman who read a passage just a caller or two ahead of me, you could hear the poetry in her voice.
That's right.
That's my entire observation. Love the book. Looking forward to the next.
Hugh, thank you. Well, speak to that, Anthony Doerr. Hugh opened the door for us. What are your next projects? What are you looking at ahead?
Oh, thanks so much, Hugh. My agent has asked me not to talk in too many specifics about my next projects because I keep blowing it and describing things that I can't finish. So I'm kind of working on three different things. I just kind of fall in love with various things that I want to read about. In many ways, fiction writing is an excuse for me to explore various curiosities, whether it's, in this case, radio in World War II, or, you know, previous books, Alzheimer's, or whale strandings, or hibernation. I just get really excited and start reading a lot about something that I'm passionate about, and that kind of fuels my sense of wonder. And then I try to invent characters and kind of translate through narrative that sense of wonder to a reader. So I'm trying to look at a bunch of different things right now and kind of water them like plants and see which one grows.
Well, let me ask it this way. Do you feel that the recognition now after this book in some ways is a burden? Do you feel the weight of expectations after a Pulitzer Prize, Anthony Doerr?
Great question. It was 2 weeks ago, so I have yet to fully understand all the implications of it. In some ways, I think the opposite is true. You feel quite liberated. I had absolutely no expectations that this book would reach very many readers. And so in some ways, I think I just will be able to stay in that place. And, you know, the prize is an amazing, wonderful thing. But I'm fully aware that there are marvelous books out there, from Marilyn Robinson to Stephen Milhauser to Shirley Hazard to Jim Shepherd, these writers that are making amazing work. I have no belief at all that I'm some great writer. I know I have a long way to go, and I'm just excited about the work of it. For me, the biggest change is just the demands and publicity. I just, my work demands a lot of time, especially reading. And, so I'm just trying to figure out how to balance this new life of talking a lot about a book that I finished over a year ago and trying to find time to keep making new stuff.
Well, you're quite modest, I must say, but I think I read that your wife read your final draft and she told you that this book was going to change things. She knew. If you didn't, she knew.
Yeah, good work, Jane. She did say that, yeah. But I didn't believe her, of course. I'm like, oh, she's just being nice.
I always ask where you were and what you were doing when you found out you'd won a Pulitzer Prize.
We were in Paris for a little while I do some promotional stuff for my European publishers. And so I was sitting, it was about 9:30 at night, and I was having mint chocolate chip ice cream with my son, Owen. And I had known the Pulitzer announcements for that day. I tried very much not to pay attention to that stuff.
But my agent had emailed me on that Saturday saying, you know, those are coming up on Monday. And so my wife was secretly in the other room watching on her iPad. I guess this year they did it on YouTube so you could watch. And then she came in shaking. She was acting very strange. She said, you won. And then both my cell phone and the apartment phone started to ring about 3 seconds later.
What was your intended message? What was your takeaway from this masterful work, from this book?
Oh, gosh. You know, when you're writing a novel, you're, at least in my case, I'm trying, almost all of my energy is on just trying to transport a reader into a seamless world and make that world as convincing as possible. And so your worldview really kind of runs underneath all that work, and it's not something you can control. And so if there are messages in there, I hope they're open-ended, and they're primarily, I hope, about empathy. I think I'm asking a reader to empathize with Marie-Laure, who is somebody who we grew up being more capable of empathizing with, you know, a character in an occupied country in many ways. A quote-unquote victim of the onslaught and the blitzkrieg of Germany taking over Europe. But I'm also asking the reader to empathize as deeply with Werner, who is somebody we're not as used to empathizing with, and for a reader to feel herself rooting for Werner, even as she understands what that means, so that she's complicit in his growing up as well. You know, I think for me, literature is a way to invest in the individual. Fundamentalism is about collective and making assumptions about groups of people. And literature is an antidote to that. I think books, particular novels, help us fall in love with individuals and understand that the truth is almost always more complicated than we think.
Anthony Doerr is author of the wonderful book, All the Light We Cannot See. Best-selling author, just won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Jane. It was fun.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.